Well, hello, ladies and gents. Thanks for coming along to our Tech Ed session. Hope everyone's having an absolutely fantastic Tech Ed this year. It's good to see the weather fined up the last few days, and glad to see that you've all decided to come along to the conference rather than hanging out around the pool and the beach. Be worried about. Just quickly, can I get a show of hands? Who in this room at the moment is a designer? Still the minority. I think there's probably more designers here than girls, I'm not sure, but who's a developer? Developers? Great. And IT pros? None? Or one? This session will be interesting for you. and what about management? Do we have any managers in here? Are managers even allowed at Tech Ed anymore? So, as I said, thank you very much for coming along to our session. We're going to be talking about designer-developer workflows, and this is something that Alex and I here have a real passion for quite a few reasons. We don't like doing too much work. We like doing efficient work instead. But secondly, we actually based most of our business model on having the most efficient workflows possible to enable our small company to compete with a lot more larger companies that are already well established. And so we hope you enjoy our session today. We've got a lot of exciting stuff to cover and a lot of content as well. So we do ask that you keep questions to the end if possible. We should have a fair bit of time at the end for questions. So yeah, that'd be great if you could do that. So just before we get into it, I'll introduce myself. My name is Jordan, and I'm one of the partners with my brother in a company called Xamling, and I form the developer half of our talk today. And as you can see there, I'm a Silverlight MVP, as is my brother Alex. I think that we might be the only two Silverlight MVPs in Australia. I'm not sure. Maybe. I didn't check. And you can check out my blog there, blog.webjack.net, and I'm also on Twitter at jackadge.
How's it going, everyone? My name's Alex. So I'm the designer side of the company, also a Silverlight MVP, and I also run a blog called Silverzine, which is sort of based around learning how to use Expression Blend and sort of tools for creating designs and that sort of thing with Silverlight. And my Twitter's up there as well if you're interested. So I think we should just get straight into it.
Yeah. So we've actually basically broken up our talk today into two main segments. We've got a few slides to throw up the front. We're going to basically break it into some talking at the start, but then a heap of actual real-life demos at the end that demonstrate how we actually go about building an application together. So first of all, we're going to pull apart what is the existing problem with designer-developer workflows, or workflows in general, where you have different styles of work taking place between your teams. For example, in this case, we're basically going to put ourselves at war with each other in the early scenarios that we go through. And then we're going to look at, I guess, ways to solve the solution. And one of those ways is investigating designer-developer workflow and what that is. And it's a hugely important part of, as I said, of how we do our work on a daily basis. And then finally, we're going to go through some of the solutions. There's a few different ways that you can tackle this problem, but we've chosen one that we really like and has really worked, and we've been using it for the last couple of years. And so we're going to have a look at how we fixed the problems that we started off with early on in our days as a company. And of course, we'll round out the whole session with a fair chunk of live examples. I think probably about the second half of the session will be all in code and in design tools and things like that. So what is the problem? Now, a little bit of background about our company, and this is why we've had to investigate the workflows that we use to a very intricate degree. Basically, here at Xamling, we focus on consumer applications. Now, I like to define consumer applications as the type of application that people actually want to use, as opposed to an enterprise application, which, I know, you know, the enterprise application can be force-fed down someone's throat and they have to use it. So they can quite often leave, you know, a little bit to the imagination. With consumer-focused applications, as I said, the whole idea is that people want to use them. Now, that want is an extremely important keyword there, in that if people don't want to use them, your application's going to be a flop. So what that leads us to is that we've had to build up quite a bit of in-house skill around UI design and user experience design, and we have this big design element that forms a really large part of all our projects. And so, you know, because we have this massive element of design, but also still work on the, you know, obviously the code and things like that, we've had to go through and smooth out our workflow processes in general. We also do a lot of consulting to other companies on how to get workflows up and running in their organizations. And these organizations may have in-house design talent. They may have... Hey, Shane. They may have in-house design talent. They may have... they might be using an agency or a design contractor or something like that. And so it's very important that we investigate this. And so something we realized very early on is that designers and developers really do like to work in different ways. They have different paces, they have different schedules, they have different things that they find important. And we found that when we actually started working really closely together on our first few projects, being a new company, we undercut the time and the price by half of what we should, so, you know, we're all stressed out, and I guess it really forced us down this path. And so, but we did find ourselves stepping on each other's toes quite a bit, and we also found that we actually work in a split team. So it's almost as if we are quite often dealing with an external agency or something like that, in that I live in Sydney, Alex lives in Melbourne, we have some contractors that live in Bendigo in Victoria. Has anyone ever heard of Bendigo? Anyone been there? Yeah, we escaped, so, and thanks for having us out on the Gold Coast. We have a lot of contractors and things like that we use as well. So we have these teams, these little pockets of teams, and even though we do work together on the same projects, as I said, we're quite often, you know, one person might not be ready with this piece of work when the other person needs it. So we had to find a way to work around that. And these split teams and all these various, you know, teams in different locations and different talents and things like that, we found we're creating a lot of dependencies. So, you know, there might be a dependency that Alex has on a piece of code that I'm writing, or there might be a dependency in that I'm waiting on a piece of design before I can go and finish off this other piece of code. And it's really hard. I'm sure you guys have dealt with this before. It's really hard to go through and I guess map out how those dependencies will work and where they slot into your project timelines and things like that. It's something that, yeah, we had to attack really early on. And something else we've also looked at and that we'll be going through today is conventions. Now, it might sound funny that you need conventions between designers and developers, because convention normally says to me it's something that you use as a piece of code. We have coding conventions that we follow, and that way, you know, developers that might come onto the project can understand what we've been doing. It also simplifies code a lot. But for us, the conventions we came up with are more like a common language, in that once we define a set of conventions and this common language that we can use to describe all parts of our project, from wireframing right through the final stage of the project, we're actually able to glean from that and to actually gather the information of what the project will look like when it's completed, so then we can work in parallel and we can actually build, you know, we can build the UI at one stage and the code at another, or we can do them together or we cannot. So it's really good. And then finally, we had to very clearly define the responsibilities. We found that sometimes it wasn't clear who was meant to go in and fix up that particular UI bug, or, you know, the user experience didn't come out the way we thought. There might be whose job is it to go and hook up the actual click event on a button, or to make an animation start, all that sort of thing. So we'll be looking at how you can clearly define that today as well. And all of this is going to culminate today, especially once you see our demo, in a really, really great parallel workflow with very little dependency between design and development time. You'll be able to see code that can be completely built without any UI. Same with the UI. You can completely build the UI without any code, including interactions and state transitions and animations and everything. And so that's what we're actually targeting today, this really great parallel workflow.
So I guess to start off, we really need to work out what designer-developer workflow is. And basically, the idea is that when creating an application, you've got two very different sides working on the project. You've got the design side, which is focusing on creating the graphics and the wireframes and the architecture for the information architecture, for the application. So working out what screen goes where and what buttons are going to do what, and And a lot of that includes also creating user experience, which is becoming more and more important these days, especially within the consumer application space. I'll just click that one. And the other side is obviously the development side of the application, where it's the logic behind the application and the interface, and actually building out a final product to sell to, or send out there. So basically, we had to work out. The old method that we were using was basically the designer would go out there, create these wireframes and these Photoshop documents and JPEGs and things, and then just dump them all over the fence. As you can see, I've done up a nice little fence there, to the developers. And basically, I would sort of say, here you go, Giotto, get to it, make it awesome. And this was a massive problem because there was obviously a lot of handover for starters. I had to explain to him how each screen worked and that sort of stuff, but also there's a lot of dependency there where Jordan would have questions about, what goes where and how's this going to look. And so basically you would find yourself sort of having to spend days and days just focusing on having the designer by your side while the application's actually being built, just to make sure that, it's going on the right track and everything's going to plan. And the other problem with that was, with user experience, there's not like a special file that you can just sort of hand over to the developer and then they know exactly how to integrate it into the application. It's the idea of how the user will interact with the application. So there was a lot of, documents and phone calls and all sorts of things going on just to get those little nuances in the application right that, it was just a nightmare. So we definitely had to find a new way of doing things.
And let's face it, developers aren't really known to have great user experience or user interface skills, and I certainly have failed many times in that regard. So the old way was no good. As you can see, I very quickly died. I'm all better now, but basically it was putting a huge amount of stress on me as a developer, in that just getting constantly chucked all these things and trying to figure out, am I doing code today or am I doing UI, and what is this UX thing anyway? I think it looks great that it's got this grey background and using the Windows theme. But we found that it was very inefficient. So for me to have to switch hats in and out of, I'm trying to write this great code and get everything working and making it testable and just doing all this, I'm just a coder, that's all I want to do. But then having to actually switch off hats and then go and think about UI, I'm pretty sure you use a different part of your brain, one that I don't have much of. And I was actually finding it was reducing, it wasn't just that I was doing more work in the UI space or, actually having to work with the UIs. It was actually when I would go back and code, and even if I had to think for just a couple of seconds about what I was doing over in the UI side, as a developer, it can quite often, a lot of the developers in the room will agree with this, if you have to switch tasks even for a moment, it can take you up to 30 minutes to get back into what you're doing, to get back into the zone. Switching from code to UI, to me, almost feels like I'm switching entire projects. Now, for the managers in the room, if you go up to a developer at mid-afternoon and say, can you just spend 20 minutes on this and then get back to what you're doing, you know the response to that. It's just, it's not the best thing to ask of somebody. And also the dependencies. So, trying to figure out which bit I need to rush so then someone can do this next bit. And same for the designers. As Alex said, when he would hand something over to me, I'd have to keep him on point for the next couple of days after he's done the handover, when he should be really thinking about the next piece of work. He also has to follow the project right through the end to make sure that what he thought would happen, the way that he thought the application would come out and the user experience and everything, that came out the way that he thought. And so we're always waiting on each other. And a lot of this led to, I think, the understanding that we were really lacking this parallel workflow that I keep talking about. And so we thought, we've got to fix this because we want to, A, take on more work because we're working so hard, but it just seemed like projects were taking forever. And so we wanted to work smarter, not harder, which is the key takeaway today. The other problem we found too was that there was a general lack of empowerment for Alex. He felt like, he started feeling bad for coming back and saying, look, mate, you are just completely ruining my designs. Please go in there and fix this up and fix that up and then wait for me to fix it and have to go back and check it. What we really wanted to find a way was for Alex to actually get in there and have a more active role in the final application itself, as opposed to generating some fantastic looking Photoshop files that then would have to be taken and actually translated into the application itself. But we're lucky. So basically, modern design and development tools have come a very long way over the last few years. And so what some of the things that we'll be looking at today, especially around Windows Phone 7 Silverlight development. Now, the concepts we're talking about today, the workflow parts, can apply to other technologies as well. And in fact, I'm doing a talk tomorrow morning on how you can apply some of the concepts we're talking about today in JavaScript and HTML5. It's at 8:15 in the morning, straight after the party, so I'm sure I'll see everybody there. I'm not particularly excited about it, but I guess if I'm not drinking, I can ride the go-karts all night, so that'll be good. So, as I said, apply the concepts to your projects. Today we're going to be looking at the tooling and the platform that's in Silverlight and Expression that enables this, but the concepts stand. So, basically we were lucky because we had this problem, but it turns out that the platform, the Silverlight platform and Expression Blend itself, they solved this problem. They've actually been designed from the ground up, from the very get-go, to support and promote efficient parallel designer developer workflows. This coupled with convention and guidance from Microsoft and other players in the field, there's great blog posts and things like that, really enables to get off the ground quickly and figure it out. And in fact, it only took us a couple of projects to almost perfect the designer-developer workflow process. I'd also like to point out a document there called The New Iteration. Now, the document was written with the release of WPF. Once again, uses the same technologies as Silverlight and Blend for WPF as well. And the new iteration, we've actually drawn a lot of the concepts that we're talking about today. We've drawn it from that document. It's a fabulous white paper there from Microsoft, very detailed, and you can pick that up and have a bit of a flick through, and it'll really give you a good idea and a refresher of what we're talking about today. But where I think everything starts with in this process is around XAML, which is the markup language that Silverlight WPF use. Of course, Silverlight running on the Windows Phone, it's identical process on there as well, obviously different screen size. But the idea is that XAML is a fantastic technology for separating the UI from the code. Now, we can't have parallel workflows without having the UI and the code completely separate. This might sound a little bit strange because if the UI and code are separate, isn't that just two different applications? Like, how does this work? So we have a look at some of the patterns today that enable that to work, but it's pretty much where it all starts. So we'll have a look at some of that today as well.
So why is this really awesome for designers? This is, you know, fantastic that we've this news. So first of all, holy crap, I'm actually building an application. This was something new to me that I was just a basic web designer, you know, sort of cutting up Photoshop documents and handing them over. So now I actually have this ability to go in and create a fully functioning UI without the need of a developer to help me along and get things working. So I can control the animations and the behaviours, the way things interact with each other. And so I've got full control over everything that will be going into the final product, which is just absolutely incredible. And it's this thing that I like to call nudge, 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 which is the ability to, when you're working with Expression Blend, it's actually running a real application inside it. So the design view that I am seeing is the application that will be in the browser or on the phone or whatever the user will be using. So this gives me the ability to quickly make changes. So I can move something a couple of pixels to the left and I can be assured that that's what will happen when the application is built. And basically, I mean, this is the greatest point of all, is that the developers just don't hate designers as much. We're not hovering around them, you know, always telling them, you know, fix this, do that, whatever. So,
as a developer, this process, as I was saying before, switching hats really, really is difficult. to go from the code to the UI is really painful. So if I can have Alex here doing more of the UI work, in fact all of it, then all of a sudden I can just really concentrate on making really, really great code. I'm not jumping in and out. I find that since we've gone for this process, I'm building far better, far more stable code. Well, it's good enough. And so this is a really important point. And in fact, it's not even a metric that you can measure. It just feels better. It just came out that way that I think that I feel like I'm writing better code and not getting as confused as part of my job. The really important point about all of this, though, is it forces good development practice. So we're looking at a few patterns today that are going to be that I think that all projects should use anyway, but because we have to build our projects in a certain way to actually get this parallel workflow to pay off and to enable Alex to be able to go and build applications in Blend when I might not have written the code yet, we have to use certain development practices and patterns. For example, model view view model that we'll be quickly looking at today, and a range of other patterns that we'll also be looking at today are very important. So I think it's a really great thing that, especially for teams that are starting up with new projects or maybe new developers, that this process has to be adhered to anyway. And also enables me to concentrate on code. Now, I'm not talking about switching hats. What I'm talking about here is that if I'm coding a straight .NET application that has no UI, I'll write that application in a very specific way. I will just be concentrating on the logic and the code that this particular application has to do. I won't be thinking about, well, how's that going to get into the UI and how's that, you know, how do I get a piece of data back? To me, if I'm writing a .NET app that has no UI, information comes in and out of properties or constructors. There's no text1.text or text1.text equals this. I'm not pushing in and out of the UI. I'm not going, when I want to show a loader, I need to go some loader control.add and then start an animation. If I want to do the concept of showing a loader, I'll create an isLoading property and I'll just set that property. Then as far as the testing framework or whatever I'm using goes, it can check the isLoading property and it says, hey, yes, it's loading at the moment. That to me is how you should write a piece of code that doesn't have any UI. So I'm finding that I'm writing, you know, far better code anyway, just because I'm not constantly stopping to think about what the UI needs to do. And of course, designers don't hate as much anymore because we don't wreck all their beautiful designs and everything like that, so, which I do a lot of.
Cool. So I just wanted to go over a couple of different types of workflows. Obviously, some are better than others. And the first one that I wanted to look at was the designer integrator developer method. And basically, this sees the introduction of a new role, the integrator, which can sometimes be the developer, but it can be a good idea to get someone in to help you out with this sort of stuff. So basically, the designer will create assets in Photoshop and hand over JPEGs and all that sort of thing. The developer will still be working on the logic as normal. And then this role, the integrator, would sort of take those the designer's work, turn them into XAML assets, and integrate them into the project. And this is really great for, especially if you've got an agency, designers working off-site, someone you like to work with that doesn't have the skills to actually build XAML assets, or doesn't have any Blend experience or anything like that. But of course there is problems with this where you can see there's a lot of handovers to get to the final product, so you're still going to need the designers on hand to sort of explain their visions and that sort of thing. The next one I wanted to quickly go over is the harvest model. And so basically this is where the designer has a little bit of experience in Expression Blend, but may not necessarily feel comfortable working on a project and integrating into an actual final product. So basically the designer will build out these XAML assets and then hand them over to the developer, who will integrate them into the project. The interesting thing about this is, then you'll see that when we do the live example, is that it's really, really easy to integrate XAML assets into your project if you've set it up correctly with resource dictionaries and that sort of thing. And the last one I just wanted to go through was just designers and developers working in complete parallel. The collaboration model, so the designer's working directly on the project, has full control over the interface from start to finish, and full control over the experience and all the animations and everything that comes with that. So they can be nudge all the time. There's just no dependency on the developer for, you know, small changes and that sort of stuff. And so it basically, it streamlines the development process, and it's just, it's the best way to do things. So there's a few little changes to the roles, and I think for designers, the biggest one is to learning what impact your designs have. Back in the old days, we didn't have to worry about it too much. We sort of just made these images, handed off to the developer, and let them sort it out. It wasn't our problem. So there is a little bit of a learning curve there for designers to learn how to create designs that work really well for the application. And obviously learning a couple of tools, I mean, it's a good idea to know a bit of Visual Studio and that sort of thing, even if you don't know how to code. I think it's important to know how to get around just enough to be dangerous. And code repositories and that sort of stuff, I wouldn't have even known what that was a couple of years ago, but now, you know, it's part of my daily life, so. Oh, gone too far.
And so for developers as well, I think there's a couple of things that you have to be willing to take on board when you start these new processes, especially around Expression Blend itself. I think it's a good idea that even though Expression Blend is a design tool, that developers at least know their way around it. Especially considering that Expression itself is going to become a target platform for your application. And this will make more sense soon, but remember Alex was saying before that Blend actually runs the Silverlight application? This is no joke. You can, in fact, attach your Visual Studio debugging process to Blend and put a breakpoint in Visual Studio and then load a control and it will hit the breakpoint. So you really have to get to understand how to actually target not only the web browser but also Expression Blend itself. I'm going to have a look at some tips today around how to actually make your code work really well in Blend as well as in the browser, the same piece of code. And that's what I mean when I say we make our code blendable. And that's a very important concept, and that's a big part of our demo today. So, as I said before, Silverlight and WPF, and of course that extends to Silverlight on Windows Phone 7, have been built from the ground up to support designer developer workflows. I should mention that one of the first projects we ever did this on was on quite a large Windows Phone 7 project, and it worked really well for us. And of course, it allows designers to have full control over the design process. So Blend is a design tool. Designers still work in Photoshop and things like that, but Blend is still a design tool as well. They might bring some assets in, but essentially, it's a design tool that instead of saving to a Photoshop format, it saves to XAML format. So you actually are working on the real application. And of course, if the designer and the integrator, if there is one in your team, are taking on more of that side of that project, and if we're using the right patterns, then we really can focus on just making the code work really well, and someone else can worry about making it look good and work as expected. And most of all, it speeds up the process. I haven't got any exact numbers, but we estimate an improvement of at least 25% in our project turnaround time, and hence, in a small company, that would directly affect our bottom line by roughly that amount the same.
So just before we get into the live example, when we start a new project at Xamling, we spend a lot of time working on wireframes. So we start out in, you know, pen and paper, start sketching out some ideas and that sort of thing. And then we move into something that's a little bit more powerful, maybe something like Sketchflow, which is actually built into the Expression Blend or Expression Suite, which is a really powerful sketching tool, and it allows you to create really detailed wireframes that have animations and all sorts of things, so you can sort of explain those extra steps that might get missed if you were just, you know, straight images. And there's a whole bunch of other tools out there. And this also allows you to get direct feedback from the client. And it's funny because the clients love these wireframes. They think that, you know, they're the best thing ever. And we actually don't do that for them. As much as they think we do, it's all for us. It puts the design and development teams on the same page from day one, so that we both know exactly where we're going, and it's just a really great way to get all those ideas out there and make sure that we make the best application possible.
Similarly, we also go through at the start of a project when we're looking at the wireframe stage, and we go through and we set up a naming convention. So a naming convention is basically we get our wireframes, and it might have a text box on there that needs to show, in our case today, the minimum temperature. We're building a little weather application that basically shows the current weather for any city in Australia. And so there might be a field that we know about when we first do the wireframes. There's going to be a minimum and a maximum. We make sure that we give those fields actual names right from the top. What this means is that if Alex is going through and building in Blend, he can create a piece of sample data, even though I might not have written a line of code yet. He can create a piece of sample data, and that sample data can reflect this naming convention. So he knows that he needs an object that's got min, max, maybe forecast text, some other things on it. We define all that up front. Similarly, if I am building the code and Alex hasn't even started the design yet, or we might just start together but not talk to each other after we've done the naming convention, I can expose properties from my code, from my classes that I write, that are min and max and everything like that. So when it's time to bring them together, Alex's finished design and my finished code, we can literally, with one single drag of a mouse in Blend, we can actually switch the sample data to be using real data without changing anything else in our project. It was simply set up from the start to work together because of the naming convention. So we usually use something like a spreadsheet to just go through and define any objects that are going to be passed into the UI. For example, in today's example, we'll be passing around a forecast object. And also, any of the other properties that might be defined on the various classes around the system that we need to pass around between the view and the code. So let's actually finish talking and let's go on and build something. So, as I said, we've got Alex will show you now. We've actually built up a little weather application. Yep. Weather application. What it does is it goes and grabs some data from the Bureau of Meteorology from an FTP server, and it loads it into our local database. We then access that database through a web service using WCF RIA services from our Silverlight application that loads the data into application and shows the weather on the screen. So Alex has basically just started here, and let's just say I'm out of town presenting at TechEd and he needs to get started.
So basically what I've got here is the start of the project. I've just sort of whipped up a blank canvas and I've added a couple of text boxes there. You see the min and max, the date. I've put a little search box up the top, and there's that empty box there, which is a list box. And the plan is to have the forecast, a three-day forecast, showing in that. So, and you can see at the moment, obviously, there's nothing in there. And if I just go into Edit Template, and this is where I would generally start creating the look and feel and the layout and that sort of stuff of those elements. If I just open that up, you can see that there's nothing in there. There's nothing to work with. So this is a really big problem for me, and I'm not going to be able to create much unless I start, you know, cutting XAML by hand and start doing all sorts of crazy stuff. So we don't want to do that. That's just going to slow everything down. So what I can do with Expression Blend is create a set of sample data. And I've already sorted this out. As you can see up the top here, I'll just bring that across. I've got the current conditions and the forecast, and you can see up there I've got the min and max, the weather state, and a couple of other little things. And so basically what I can do, I can actually just drag these straight onto the canvas. And that's all being sorted out from Blend. It's doing it all for me. Yeah, thanks. So that's all being done under the covers of Blend, and I don't even have to worry about that. And the beauty of it is that these are all the names that we decided earlier in the naming convention. And so what else? The next thing I'm going to do is just grab this forecast collection, which is an array of days, and you can see there that it's dropped in some data. It's not very close to what we're looking at. You see the couple of numbers there, but some random text and that sort of stuff. What we don't have here is a date field. So I can just really quickly create a new field of data, and I'll just call it date. And inside Blend, it actually gives you all these options to create different types of data. Obviously, date there, company name, email address, all sorts of things. There's numbers, images, whatever you need. So I'll just select date, grab that, and just drag it on. And so now that's bound to the data that hopefully later when Giotto gets his act together, we'll be able to just switch it back in and it'll all just be peachy. So now I'll just quickly show you again, if I jump back into that that template, you can now see that I've got access to these items and I can actually start, you know, making them look pretty, you know, quickly just changing sizes of things and all sorts of stuff. So that's just speeding up the process tenfold already, and I haven't even had to annoy Jordan for any of the data or anything like that.
Cool. So I think it's important to note that Alex was able to create the sample data himself and drag the elements onto the text fields and onto the list box. That is the last time that there will be any type of mapping between our data and our view. Because we've used the same names now in our project, other than spelling mistakes that Alex might have made, we've had a few of them in the past, but because we've used the same data now, when I actually go and make the real data, we can just drop it straight in and it will start showing up. So I'm going to demonstrate that now for you guys. And just before I do that, I'm just going to check something that Alex forgot to drag on, and I just want to make sure it doesn't... It's all Alex's fault if it fails. Ah, it looks good. Okay. That should be okay. Okay. So, over in Visual Studio, basically, I can build my code and everything like that without affecting Alex's designs. He's quite happy to go across, and we could even be checking in together. Like, he could be checking his designs into the exact same project, but we can still work separately until I'm ready to actually expose the work that I've been doing on him. Now, the way that I'm actually building this project from my side is using the model view view model pattern. So this isn't an MVVM talk, this is more a conceptual talk, but for those of you who haven't used MVVM or may have heard of it but aren't too familiar with it, basically it's a separated UI presentation pattern. So the idea is that, as we've been banging on about, that you want to have the code over one side and the view over one over another side and have a very clear separation between them both. So model view view model. You've got the model, which is basically, I would consider things like your data access, so accessing web services and things like that, and any other business processing that you might like to do. And then you've got the view, which is your XAML, or if it was HTML, it'd be HTML, for example. And then in between them both, you've got the view model. Now, the view model's responsibility is to go to the model to ask for information, maybe set it up in a way that suits the view, but then just expose that through a series of properties to the view. It doesn't actually know anything about the view. It doesn't know what animations are in there. It doesn't know what the text boxes are called. It doesn't know anything. But it knows that the view is probably going to want a forecast. So I can just expose this forecast through an object. So these view models are actually, at the end of the day, These view models, at the end of the day, are actually just classes. So I've got this main page view model that I'm going to use as the data context, as the object that Alex dragged on, the sample data. I'm going to, soon enough, replace that sample data with this real version of the view model. It's just a class that contains a series of properties. The only way to get a piece of information from a view model into the view is through a property. The view will then use data binding with that same name as the property to pick up that piece of data. Now, what I can do is, let's just say, for example, I've got min and max being exposed, but then the user does a search, and so obviously that data has to change. What I can actually do is have the min and max properties, and when the new data comes in, I can just update those properties, and through a mechanism known as the iNotify property changed interface, we can actually tell the view that those properties changed. So I can just go in and say, this is the new min value, this is the new max value for temperatures, and that piece of information will just end up in the view and automatically display. So there's no extra piece of code there to tell them that something happened or to go and update a text box or anything. It works purely through convention. So that's basically MVVM in a nutshell. Now, what we've got though is this interesting problem in that once we drag in my new view model, Alex still needs to be able to use this application in Blend. Now, being a developer, I've probably got 57 versions of SQL Server running and IIS configured up the Wuha and maybe Azure Toolkit and all this other stuff running on my PC. It can be very difficult to actually keep this environment updated on all these other devices and on all these other people's machines, especially if they're actually external to the organization. So you've got someone trying to work on this project who might be a contractor, who doesn't have your standard operating environment or something like that. They're just outside the process. For me, it's more like, how do I run this SQL script again? How do I do this? How do I get it all set up? So what we want to do is we want to make sure that even though we're using a real view model, we want to make sure that we have the ability to still use sample data. More real sample data, but for all intents and purposes, still sample data. So remember I was saying that you've got this model, which is separate from the view model. So the view model is charged with shepherding information into the view, but it shouldn't actually get that information or know how to get it. So what I've actually done here is I've got this thing called a service locator. The service locator's job is to go and get me services. The service could be how to save something to the file system. It could be how to load an image. In this case, my service is a weather repo, a weather repository. And that weather repo says to me that it probably goes and gets a piece of weather information for me. How it goes and does that, I don't know. Also, and you'll note this in a minute, I don't know what the service locator is doing internally to give me that. So let's go and grab this... go and have a look at what this repo here is getting me. So the service locator in this project is just a really, really simple class. No dependency injection or anything like that to confuse things. It's just a really simple class that has some bunch of static properties on it. And this one I'm interested in here is this repo. We still don't know what the repo does yet. We'll get to that. But basically, I go and say to this service locator, I want a repo to go and get some weather. It's got this check in here and says, am I in the design tool or not? If I'm in the design tool, I actually want to get the design version of the repo. Otherwise, I want to just get the normal version. And then it sends it back to the view model. In the view model, I don't know which one it got. Because because both of them are implementing this iWeather repo interface, and we'll have a look at what's in those guys in a minute, because they're both implementing that, I don't know which one I get back. So effectively, remember I say that your code runs in Blend. When I'm in Blend, this guy's going to give me the design version, and when I'm running in the browser, it's going to give me the real version, but I code against them exactly the same. My view model has not one if test in it. It doesn't know whether it's in Blend or whether it's running for real. This, to me, really simplifies my coding because I can write those two repos, single responsibility and everything like that. Each one knows how that particular instance of itself needs to load data. So let's have a look at those. So firstly, we've got these repos here. I've got the weather repo, and I've broken them down into folders, and you can see I've got the design version and an online version. The online version here, I'm actually using WCF Rea Services to go and get some information off my server. Now, for those of you who haven't used WCF Rea Services, and it's an absolutely fantastic way to really, I guess, simplify interactions with WCF, Windows Communication Foundation, and make some really great services for use in Rea applications. And that's not just Silverlight. I also use Rea services extensively as part of my HTML5 applications as well. It works really, really well with both of them, especially around authentication and things like that. But in this case, all you need to know is that you can see there I'm going, get me a forecast for a city. I'm giving you the city name, and it's obviously going to go up to the server. The server's going to do its thing and load our database and give me back a piece of XML that gets parsed out and everything like that. Behind the scenes, of course. That gets parsed out ready for me to actually display on the screen. If we go and have a look at the other one, where are we? There we are. The design version. Once again, iWeather repo. This time I go get forecast for city. I still take the city. It's exactly the same signature. But this time I'm actually going, and I've got this little class, this little helper that goes and loads me some test data. So all I did to get that test data is I just ran a real version and just collected the XML it sent me, copied and pasted into a file in my Silverlight project. And I just searched for Bendigo and got Bendigo's weather as it was, I think, yesterday or the day before. Then what I'm doing is I'm just doing a little bit of simple serialization here on the XML that's come out, and I'm deserializing that back into a real entity as if I got it off the server. The interesting thing, as I was stating, is that you don't know which version of these you're going to get. It doesn't matter. Why would the view model even care which version it's getting? They work exactly the same as far as it's concerned, which is pretty cool. So what I want to do is I've actually just about ready to check in some stuff for Alex here. And so what I might do is I might just go into my application configuration file here. And you'll see there we've got the sample view model already there that Alex created in Blend. He basically just went new data source and started typing. And it shows up there like this. What I can actually do is do the same thing for my view model. So I go to main page view model here, and I'll uncomment this guy, such, and build it. And then what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to jump across into Blend, back into Alex's zone for a minute. And this is sort of what I mean by developers probably should get to know the design tools. But what I can do now is, remember Alex had this sample data in there, and we started off by dragging the view model onto the root of the page. So what I can actually do here is my view model now shows up in Alex's data. So it's not just sample data, it's actually real data as well. So I can go through here and I can grab my view model, one swipe once I'm finished, ready to go, bang that in there and save it, and all of a sudden the real data will appear. So I'm going to hand over to Alex now. He's ready to check in his changes as well.
Cool. Now that we've got all that boring stuff out of the way, we can get back into looking at actually implementing the design. So I've been obviously working away while Giordo's been organising all the data stuff. I've already mocked out this data here. The XAML. You can see here I've got some pages of stuff. I did all this on the design surface, so I wasn't sort of cutting any of this by hand, so I've just copied it out. And this is a great example of how easy it is to actually integrate someone else's XAML into your project as well. So I'm just going to basically grab all that, and I'll have to just quickly go over here and open up the restyles. So basically all I've done there is I've just pasted in a bunch of styles, and they still need to be hooked up. As you can see, it's still the boring old wireframe style document. So I'll just jump across here, and all I've done in this one, this is exactly the same as the main page that we were using before, except that now I've actually hooked up the styles to, you know, so the button knows that I need that style to make it look good. So I'll just jump in there. And with a bit of luck, we got some pictures.
Yeah, so it's important to note there that even though Alex pasted that in, that could have been a get latest for me from source control. So he's actually done that entirely separately from my process, and yet they still work together.
And so now you can see, obviously, I can jump back into the generated items that we were looking at earlier, the layout for the forecast, and as you can see now, I can just start, you know, moving things around. And this is actually running while I'm sort of editing it. So it's basic. It's almost like, you know, if you were actually editing a HTML page in Internet Explorer or something like that. So I'll just save that again. And what I'll do is I'll just run it up quickly. Cool. So we thought it'd be a really cool idea to to show whether it was sunny or windy, we thought it'd be really cool to do sort of an atmospheric-y type thing. So I've had to add in a few little buttons down here. But basically, the idea is that, you know, when it's sunny, the sun will be up. Windy, we've got some little wind turbines going. Cloudy, rain. I love the lightning. Partly cloudy, ice and snow. So what I've done, and this is awesome feature of Expression Blend, is what's called the Visual State Manager. And basically, it allows me to create different states of the visuals on the application. So you can see there I've got sunny, windy, cloudy, rain, all those things. And basically, all I have to do is I select sunny, it sort of starts recording what I'm doing, and then I just start making changes to my application. So I'm doing it very quickly. And the coolest thing is that when you change from state to state, Silverlight or Expression Blend just handles all those transitions for me. I can just put a number on it, so 2 seconds to go from this state to that state, and it's all sorted out for me. Just grab that.
So you might like to see the states in the
list box. So, and I've done the same thing in the list box, which I should have shown while I had it up before. But basically, I've added in eye sunny, eye windy. And so you can see that basically all that one's doing is just changing a couple little images there. So, but the problem I've got now is that Jordan is sending me data saying, okay, today's sunny, but I need to be able to translate that into changing my states. And so usually we would have this problem, but Giordo is going to quickly go over how to sort it out with one fell swoop.
So the problem is that my code it's got a property in it that says it is currently sunny or it's currently windy or it's something like that. It's actually just an enumeration that I've populated based on the weather data. But we need a way to actually describe to the view, hey, it's sunny, it's rainy, so it knows how to switch into these states that Alex has created. Two things. First of all, you'll note that the states that Alex created, he was able to actually create all of those and work on them without me having to write a line of code. So in the design tool, he can go through and figure out how they should all look. He doesn't have to wait for me to write some code that then switches between these states or anything like that. The other problem that we have, though, is that I'm exposing this property on whether it's sunny or windy, but then we need a way to actually, tell it to switch states. But keeping in mind that we never want our code to know about our view, so we need to figure out a way to actually get around this and have, I guess, the view still pull in what state to be in. So what we've actually got is a few options here. And I'm just going to fix up something just here before we get too far into it. Excuse me for a second. Where is it? A lot of stuff. Oh, no, it should be okay. We have a lot of options to get around this. Now, Expression Blend and Silverlight support something known as behaviours. And what behaviours are is they're basically a piece of XAML that you can put in that enables you to data bind to a property and then write some code, but offline. So this is like a behaviour that you write. It's not like a piece of code that's specific to this application, and you can download them off the internet. And it takes that bound property and does something with it. So, and also when that bound property changes, it does something else with it. So it knows that the property changed and can do something else. Now, one of these behaviours that we can actually look at here is something known as the data state switch behaviour. It's part of the Expression Blend tools and things like that. In fact, these behaviours can actually be designed and created. If I just move this junk away. So you can see here we've got all these behaviours. So there's quite a few of them. We can change properties. We can do things when you click things. We can switch between states. We can do all sorts of wonderful things. There is a stack of them. They show up under the behaviours thing. And, of course, you can write your own and also download more. The one I'm interested in is the data state switch behaviour. So what this guy does is basically I bind to a property, and then I write, and then I put in some switch statements. So I go, if the property equals sunny, then go to the sunny state. If the property equals something else, go to that state and things like that. So I can give it a whole range of cases that enable it to automatically go and do it. So what I've actually done is I've done this piece of configuration already, and I do apologise, this is for brevity. But basically, first of all, I'm just going to drop out of Blend there. So first of all, I'm going to go and paste in the list box states. So Alex has got those list box, but at the moment, if I run the application, they're not really showing, any of the sunny states and all that sort of thing. And also, the background isn't automatically switching to the sunny state or the rainy state, depending on what the weather's doing. So you can see here, there's meant to be sun and everything there. Alex has done the states, and I've done the work to actually expose them. We just need to sort of link them up through data binding, though, of course. So Alex has actually got, in his styles area here, I'm just going to go down and find it. There it is there. I'm going to paste in this and explain this to you guys. So first of all, when I actually originally did this by dragging a behavior on it, it automatically created all this stuff for me. But unfortunately, to go and recreate these 10 odd states, it would have taken too long to do on stage. But you can see here, what I've done is I've actually gone and said, bind to the weather state. That's my enumeration that defines the states that are available. And then I go and say, if it's sunny, go to the iSunny state. Alex did that bit. I did that bit. But right up front, we decided what those names would be. So we didn't have to sort of sit back and go, hey, what's the sunny state called? We already knew that from the get-go. Similarly, on the homepage there, we've got another one that's exactly the same. And I'm just going to go and find that guy. There it is. And once again, we're going off. This time I'm going off to my forecast, and there's a little bit of extra there. I can go forecast. I want the current forecast, because obviously the forecast object might have forecast.future forecasts, and there might be a list of those, which is what we're seeing populating that list, and the weather state. Same weather state object, though. Once again, we've got sunny, partly cloudy, and everything like that. So if we go and run our application, let's just do that for a second. Fire it up. And it's automatically gone, and it's actually done an automatic search for Bendigo. So if I go in here and search for Darwin, for example, straight away finds Darwin, I think Perth. This is cache data from yesterday, just to be safe. So we've got Perth there as well. And so you can see that a couple of things. I just go in and get a new forecast and bang it into that property. That's all I do in my code. There's nothing else. But it does all this extra thing. Like I'm doing amazing animations, and you know, we could be doing stuff that's far more crazy than this. This is just an on-stage demo. It's so easy to build. I thought about the code and got it all ready. Alex thought about this, and it only took us sort of around about a day to get all this together and have something ready to present to you guys. So there's a lot. I mean, there's a lot of moving parts and things like that. The patterns are very well understood, though. And they're very well documented, so I really suggest that you guys go out there and have a look at them. And I just wanted to finish off by demonstrating to you. Let's have a look here. I just wanted to show you that the app really is running in Blend. Just, you know, a bit of proof. You know, it's easy enough to say those sorts of things on stage. I'm just going to stop that app at the moment. First, I'm going to go back in and find my spot. There it is there. Main page, going to Blend. Cool. All right, Blend's popping up. And I'm just going to shut that guy down there. I'm going to go back in here. And I'm remembering that we're now using the real data, so I'm just going to go and grab the main page here. Whoops, I'm going to grab the model, sorry, the view model. I'm going to put a breakpoint right here. I'm going to go debug, attach to process, Blend. I'm going to go into Blend, your projects, and I'm going to find that file in here, and I'm going to open him. And you see the breakpoint got hit in Visual Studio. Now, if I hover over this repo here, you can see that it's automatically giving me back the design version. So my code doesn't know which one it is. The exact same breakpoint, if I then stop that, but run it in here, and hit that same breakpoint. You can see it's the online version of that very same thing, the difference being there. So that's pretty cool, huh? I reckon that's pretty sweet. Okay, so that's pretty much everything we wanted to talk to you about today. Basically, remember that just because you are doing your code, on one side and your design on the other, you should really know about what the other's doing. I mean, anyway, it's very easy to fall in the trap of completely ignoring what's going on over the other side of the fence, but you should still do it. So we'll finish up there. We've got some time left for questions, if anyone's got any questions, and we'll just pop up our contact details there again. So we'll throw open the floor to any questions that you guys may have. Yes?
You say that you can do the work independently for designer and the developer, but what I can see from your demo is that you still need for developers still need the user interface, for the designer still need to use your code. How can you...
Okay, so the question was, how is it that the designer can do their piece of work without the code and the developer can do their piece of work without the code? Okay, so Alex could have gone into Blend and just created sample data straight off the bat. And then he didn't need any code. There still is code behind the scenes, but he doesn't need my code.
But you need his code.
No, I don't. So I can actually go in and create my view model. And when that project first started, there was no association between the view model and the actual code itself and the view itself either. So there is quite a difference there. Yeah. Is there any other questions? Nope. Oh, yeah.
How do you manage conflicts when you have version control? Because one problem with XAML is that it's pretty hard to merge.
Yeah.
How do you guys do that?
So basically, we don't actually usually run into a lot of conflicts because of our naming convention. If two people are working on the same file, that can happen, but I think that if you use tools like either BeyondCompare or KDIFF, that the automatic merging is a lot better. So, yeah, it usually gets around that. Yep. Any other questions? All right, well, thank you very much, guys.